This is tape one, side two of the Crawford Thompson interview, 7/29/87. So you've been sketching out for us the elements that went into a contract. So to get back to our original discussion about Frank Kolbaum coming to you for these various contracts, especially for Rand, this kind of information would be what you would convey to him in terms of providing the boilerplate.
Yes. Well, what I'm really leading up to in all this is, it was either September or October of 1945. Frank apparently had been up and talked to Larry Tollefson. Larry asked me if I could come over to his house over the weekend. This was on a Friday. And sit down, and the two of us sit down and try and work out a suitable cost section for a new type of contract. And that's all he told me that day. But when I got over there, this was the concept of a long-range research contract to make recommendations to the Air Force in the post-war period. I'm paraphrasing this. So we sat down for several hours in the afternoon on Sunday and wrote down everything we could think of that would be an unusual type of cost to a contracting officer and an auditor for the, and it was in the Army Air Corps still, given the fact that the contracting officers and auditors were basically accustomed to hardware type contracts, not research. And I think this is probably true all over the country. So we thought of all kinds of things, books, film, I've forgotten now all the items, but we came up with like 20 to 25 items. Now, prior to the end of the war, and for some time after, there was no such thing as armed services procurement regulations. There was nothing. The standard boilerplate included a reference to something called TD-5000, TD standing for Treasury Department. And the Treasury Department at some point, I have no idea when it was first written, but it was pre-World War II, they had written some broad cost principles for why, I don't know, why they did it, I don't know, but anyway, they did. And they were just very broad and nothing specific in them. But that's all the auditors had to go by as far as a list of allowable costs. And since it had been used, quotes, and I'm not sure anyone used it, but that was the only guide that government auditors had, unless they had something internally that their particular office had made up. But clearly this was inadequate to put in the contract for research where you were, in our view anyway, where you were going to be having all kinds of unusual purchases. And we had things later on like subscribing to the daily racing form, buying BBs, you know, this sounds like something you shouldn't be doing, or you bought it for your children or whatever. But there was a very good reason why we needed these.
On what experience, when you dreamt up the initial list, you had been trained, you'd had graduate education, but I take it you hadn't really worked in pure research or even applied research, aside from what you might have been doing in preparation for your degree. Is what sort of experience did you and Taliesin draw on to try to dream up what a bunch of researchers would need that might look funny to a contracting officer?
No, we just did the best we could with not a lot of background. I mean, we realized the problem that we were going to have some way of getting auditors. And at this point, we knew that the plan was that the contract be let to Douglas Aircraft. And we did know the auditor and the contracting officer who were stationed there at that time. And we had a pretty good idea what their reaction would be to types of costs that weren't involved in the manufacture of aircraft. Now, that didn't mean that we were clairvoyant as to each and every one that we might run into.
You didn't immediately put racing forms on the first list.
No, no. But we did cover things like subscriptions to scientific magazines and so on. Because in a manufacturing operation, either these get dumped into overhead or some companies, and Douglas would probably have been one of them, since they were fairly tight-fisted. Some companies would feel, if you're an engineer, that this is something that you should keep up personally, to just like a doctor subscribes to medical journals, rather than a government contract reimbursing it as a direct cost. You see, we anticipated getting, well, if you only have one contract and you don't have a fixed overhead rate, direct and indirect costs are essentially the same, because you have to get reimbursed for all of them, and you have nothing to spread it to but one contract. Indeed, that's what we did for the early years. We billed each month all of our costs. Well, I happened to write the accounting system before we started operating on our own. And while we made provision for overhead accounts and direct accounts, realizing at some point in the future, with any luck at all, we'd have more than one contract. But we did not operate it that way. I mean, there's no point in spreading it to one base. It's going to come out the same as if you bill them all as you incur them. So rather than do that, we simply vouchered everything. Now, I'm jumping ahead now to when we were on our own, not within Douglas. It turned out Douglas insisted on having a fixed overhead rate when the first project ran contract, so we had a true fixed overhead rate on that, because we had to adhere to Douglas's accounting policies as long as we were Douglas employees. But I'm jumping ahead a little here. So, out of this list of items, We simply made the list, and I guess we gave it to Frank and Arthur Raymond, probably, or to Frank, and he must have showed it to Arthur. But let me go back just briefly here, if you want my recollections on the concept. There were, let's see, one, two, three. there were like five people involved in the original discussions, as I've always heard and understood the story. One of them, of course, was General Arnold, who was the head of the Army Air Corps. And there was Edward Bowles, run into his name, I'm sure. He was the special consultant to General Arnold and to the Secretary of War. And then there was Vannevar Bush, who was the head of OSRD, the Office of Scientific Research and Development. And Douglas had I believe we had a small contract with OSRD and Douglas. At least there was contact between Arthur Raymond and Vannevar Bush. They knew each other, and Frank knew Vannevar Bush. And I think he, my recollection is that Bush as well, if not more so than General Arnold, decried the fact that all of his civilian talent was going to leave the government the day the war was over. Most of them couldn't stand working for the government, because wherever they'd been before, whether it was an academic institution or wherever, they'd had a lot more freedom, and they weren't subject to the usual government rules and regulations. So while they were willing to work for the government during the war, they just couldn't wait to get back to their civilian jobs. And both General Arnold and Bush felt there was going to be an ongoing problem with Russia, and they didn't want to see all this talent turning to other subjects. So they felt it would be nice if there was a private corporation that wasn't subject to all of the government's rules and regulations, that could harness this talent and interest these people in working for the Air Corps, Air Force, or, you know, it evolved twice in the different names, in the future to study long-range problems with Russia. That was what he wanted. And I'm sure there were a number of discussions, I don't know how many, among those people, plus Arthur Raymond and Frank Kolbaum, and at some point with Mr. Douglas, when they got to where they were all agreed that it was worth trying and where could they start it. Douglas was chosen really for want of a better place, and the fact that Arthur Raymond and Frank Kolbaum happened to be Douglas' employees, obviously it could have been started any place as far as the way we had to go about it. So the next step was General Arnold went to, I'm not sure whether it was Congress or the Secretary of War, but somehow or other he got $10 million. And his proposal was that Douglas undertake this with a very broad statement of work. I'm sure you've seen the statement of work.
Yeah.
Under which you could do most anything. And he meaning General Arnold, wanted such a group started, and he wanted the group to, which is the unique part of the contract, to really design its own technical program. Because he felt, well, the problem the Air Force faces today too is that they're so busy, it isn't that they don't have talent, but they're so busy on their day-to-day problems, they haven't got time to think about what's going to happen 5, 10, whatever years in the future. There's just no way they're ever going to be able to do that. So I think in general, over the years, the Air Force has certainly been sympathetic to having a company such as RAND. That doesn't mean that we have always been as responsive as they would like us to be to short-term projects. Basically, Rand has never wanted to do short-term projects. We feel that's really our talents, and I don't want to say wasted, but should be directed toward long-term. Now I'm getting into research, which is not my field, but that was the concept. And I can recall, Frank used to tell the story of the first project manager of Project Rand was General LeMay. And I forgot, and he had a new title they created within the Air Force. And I don't remember offhand what that was, but there was a meeting, and I don't even recall who all was at it in Washington, where General Arnold was telling General LeMay that he wanted to be sure that Rand had access to intelligence data. And General LeMay, I guess, thinking he was, in effect saluting and saying, "Yes, sir," he said, "You can rest assured that as soon as I'm finished with it, they will have it." General Arnold, according to Frank, said, "You don't understand me. They get it as soon as or before you get it." So that was the message from General Arnold to General LeMay. I don't know that General LeMay ever agreed with that, but those were his original orders, is my understanding. Anyway, he was our project leader for some time until he, as you know, became the head of SAC in Omaha.
Just to back up, so at this time in late 45 and early 46, how much aware were you of these interconnections and the individuals involved? Were you knowledgeable about it at that time, can you recall?
Well, I was knowledgeable about General Arnold and certainly Frank Kolbaum and Arthur Raymond. I've forgotten when I first learned about Bowles and Bush having been involved. It was early.
Okay.
But your main business dealings with the Air Force would have been through Wright Field,
yeah.
I believe.
Mm-hmm. That's where the first contract was written. And that's my next point here, actually. Right after we'd made up the list and so on, sometime in the next month, the Wright Field people called, and their attorney, whose name I could find, but I can't recall offhand. And he came out and sat down first with the chief counsel of Douglas, a man named Fred Hines, H-I-N-E-S. But quickly, since Fred didn't really negotiate contracts, the lawyer and Larry Tollison and I ended up sitting down and going over all these items. One of the reasons they've gotten, they never really came into play because the lawyer was horrified at putting like 20 some items of allowable cost in a contract. He'd never heard of that before, and he didn't think it was a very good idea. So he came up with some language, and I've got the key line here, I can remember. But after he put in the usual ones of salaries and consultants' fees and travel and direct purchases and so on, the usual standard ones that are in just about every contract. Then he put in one that said, and I'm paraphrasing this, all other items of allowable cost both similar and dissimilar to the above. Now, no one knew what the hell it meant. But we weren't going to argue, because it seemed to us that covered anything you could think of. And it was his suggestion, not ours. So that's the way he collapsed the rest of our items into this one provision that was rather...
That was the Douglas lawyer who did that for you, or the Wright Field lawyer.
The Wright Field lawyer.
Wright Field lawyer.
The Douglas lawyer wasn't in the meeting with us. He didn't really participate in those things. He was... The chief counsel for Douglas mainly was, you know, interested in corporate policy and in litigation and that sort of thing for Douglas, because he had a stable of like 8 lawyers working for him. He had a tax lawyer and this, that, and the other thing. And he had one for our Air Force contracts and one for Navy, and so he didn't get involved in the... it had to be a fairly big problem concerned with basic corporate policy before he got involved.
If we could, before you proceed with the rest of your outline here, I'd like to go back and just touch on a couple things at Douglas. What was your, you described the activities of the contract administration office and the relationship with the plants. What was that office's interaction with upper management of Douglas? How did that work? Did you, for example, sit down on regular meetings and then talk about contract issues with the vice presidents or Don Douglas? How did that work?
Not with Donald Douglas. He didn't talk to anyone most of the time. I mean, I was in his office a few times with one of the vice presidents, but basically no one went directly to him. He went to a vice president. And Larry Tollefson reported to a vice president, so and the way Larry worked with us, if it was our contract, we went to the vice president. So it came up during the course of coordinating either a contract or an amendment to a contract, because all those were signed off on by the vice presidents. There weren't that many vice presidents. There were only like 4 then. So if they had any question on the coordination, you know, like they'd call me and I'd run down to their office and we'd sit down and talk about it. And usually the discussion was about, I don't like this, can't we get something better, or is it possible to get it deleted entirely, or whatever his problem was. And occasionally, if it happened to be the first or second one on vice president on the coordination list, he would usually say, well, let's wait and see when Ted Conan was the senior vice president, what Ted has to say about it. In other words, they didn't want to take too strong a position if the senior vice president was going to call him up and give him hell for whatever reason. So anyway, in the course of all this, the 3 of us, Larry and Edmund, I did deal directly with the vice presidents. Occasionally we would deal with someone on their staff if it was a cost proposal, for example, and we had some questions. We knew that the senior vice president's right-hand subordinate was the one that prepared all the cost proposals. I'd go directly to him, because the senior vice president clearly wasn't going to know why this little amount of money had been set aside for whatever. Basically our dealings were with the vice presidents as far as the contracts were concerned. The other aspects of the administration of the contracts, we normally would not deal with the vice presidents. There, for example, I would deal with the people back at Douglas El Segundo. If it was a matter of, you know, the contract, a new contract or an amendment has just been signed, I'd usually go over there and sit down with usually the assistant plan manager, because he was the one that was more involved in contracts than the plan manager. He directed the bulk of his efforts to the manufacturing process. But there, you know, there's no point in talking to a vice president about how to implement one of the plans. So that's somebody else's job. If something went wrong, the appropriate vice president would get into it, but directly with the plan. Something went wrong in the sense they weren't following the contract, or they were overrunning, or whatever.
And which vice president did you report to? What was his title?
His title was, it had been vice president of sales, but they had to quickly change the titles when the war came along, because theoretically we couldn't make any sales, so other than work for the government that is treated as sales. So they quickly changed it to contract administration, so he was the vice president of contract administration. And then he reverted the sales after the war ended.
And besides the vice president for engineering, which Arthur Raymond was, who were the other vice presidents?
Yeah, there was the senior vice president was he was senior vice president and vice president of manufacturing.
And that was Ted Conan.
Ted Conan, yeah. He was also a sailing buddy of Mr. Douglas's for years and years and years. And then there was a vice president - controller who was the financial head. And I believe in contract administration, there were just the four of them. Okay. They have a ton of them today. That's because of their merger, et cetera.
Before we flesh out the RAND thing a little bit more, I'm wondering what the feeling was around Douglas and from your perspective as the war was coming to an end and you were considering your prospects in the post-war period.
It's a broad question. I can recall since I was involved the day the war ended, because and we kind of expected it, so it wasn't a surprise. But what the government did, which is the easy way out, knowing the war was coming to an end, you know, they had contracts with everyone all over the country, and they knew that they didn't want them to continue working at whatever the rates were under them, so they had to terminate them. However, there were a lot of the contracts, or some of the contracts, that it was clear both to the government people and to us that they really didn't want to terminate. They wanted to continue them, maybe not at the same rate or the same number, but in some fashion. What they did, they'd made up all these termination notices, and they had them all on tapes to go into a teletype machine. And they just pulled the switch the minute the war was over. And these things, as fast as they could come off the teletype machine, were coming in. Wed Curtis and I, since there were just the two of us, we split the clock from midnight to noon. And we set ourselves up in the boardroom, which was right between Mr. Douglas's office and Ted Conan's office. As soon as those things got in there, we had to grab the right file and figure out whether they really meant to cancel all of it or not. Because if they do, you know, you got to stop work immediately, you got to fire everyone, and time is of the essence to shut the costs off.
Okay, because so these notices were coming across the teletype, and
right.
They were not saying to terminate in a day or two or in a week.
Well, it says, the way it operates is, it says, pursuant to article such and such, termination of contract such and such, your contract is hereby totally terminated. Then you go look at the contract as to what you have to do, which is the section which says, you stop all work immediately and you do this, that, and the other thing. Of course, payroll is the big thing. That's where your expenses. Well, for example, we ran into a problem at the Tulsa plant. They had a new young ACO there. And they had a procedure when an employee terminates from the shop, they had to check out his toolbox. And if he, because Douglas furnished the tools. And if any tools were missing, he had to pay for them, and it came out of his termination check. Well, that's, you know, all well and good if you aren't deluged. But here we had all the, you know, we had to close that plant. And we had, I don't know how many thousands of people to terminate. You haven't got time to check the tools because the meter's running on their salaries. Well, it took us a day and a half and going over his head in the right field to finally convince him that don't check the tools. You take the toolbox, you throw it in a big pile, and you get him out the gate. It's a heck of a lot cheaper than, you know, having these thousands of people waiting for days until you can check their darn toolbox and charge them $5 or whatever for a missing wrench. You know, that's the sort of thing that, I mean, you know, he'd never run into the situation before. Of course, we hadn't run into it on that scale, but we did realize that you shut the payroll off before you do anything because they have no work to do. There's no point. And we were, of course, afraid that if we didn't do it that way, then we wouldn't get reimbursed for the keeping a guy on, let's say, 3 or 4 days where you should have been able to get him out the same day or the next day or whatever is considered to be reasonable.
So any aircraft that were under assembly just froze right there, they whatever state they were in.
They sure did. Now, once we shut the costs off, however, you then have to get, see, that's all government property. And then you've got to get disposition instructions of what to do with all these aircraft in various stages of completion. In Oklahoma City, for example, what we did, when I say we, I'm talking about Douglas here, but what happened was Douglas decided to buy, it was like 18 or 20 of the partially completed C-47. That was the military version of the DC-3. And make them into executive airplanes. So we actually negotiated with the government contracting officer to buy the partially completed ones, and then they were in various states because they were on an assembly line, buy them, and then Douglas, at that point, took over making them into executive, custom-made executive models, mainly for Texas oil men were the ones that bought them. And Douglas paid all the costs of finishing them and putting the fancy interiors in and then sold them, which, of course, paid back the government for whatever it had cost to get them that far toward completion. But these things go on, and it took us, I got involved in all the termination doings of Douglas at the end of World War II. It sometimes would take, gosh, a year to complete some contract, especially if you had any third-party claims pending. You know, a lawsuit for this, that, or the other thing. And, you know, with six companies, you were bound to have some of those kicking around. But it was a, you know, fairly long job. You have to inventory everything and account for all the government-furnished equipment you got on hand. And it's not a trivial pursuit. That was my same thing happened in those overseas contracts I was referring to. Terrible time disposing of the property. I got a letter one day with 18 endorsements on it. It had come from an army captain who was the last person left in Eritrea on the site, requesting disposition instructions for the following list of material. The reason it had the 18 endorsements and finally got to me and Douglas was that there was some government property that was not U.S. government property in there. And no one could figure out where it came from or what to do with it. Well, it was the, when they went into Eritrea, they found the old machine shops from when Mussolini had invaded Ethiopia through Eritrea. And it was the machine shops that the Italians had set up and used to repair their tanks and so on. And they'd abandoned them when they pulled out eventually and just left them there. Well, when the Douglas people got over there, they found some of these things were usable, so they started using them. And of course, they left them when they departed at the end. So this poor captain, so his mistake was ever listing that. You know, he may still be there waiting for an answer, for all I know. I knew where he'd come from, luckily. So I started it back through the 18 endorsements, and I never heard anything more. But there was... Anyway, it takes a while to undo something. The other thing was, on the ones that we knew and the government knew in a general sense shouldn't be terminated, at least completely, we had to hurry up and get a revised estimated cost back to them so they could amend the contract. But in the meantime, we haven't got any coverage. It's been chopped off. So what do you do with the people until you get an exchange of telegrams that amended to a partial termination? That's why we were working, Ed and I were there around the clock, because we had to get those telegrams going back the other way, or we had some uncovered costs for a day or whatever period of time, and it was usually more like a week, because you have nothing to do with the people, especially when you're shrinking with that big a reduction in business. You know, sometimes you can put them on some other contract usefully, but there was no place to put these people. So anyway, the mood in our little group was certainly one of a frenzied effort to keep the cover, all the coverage we could for the projects that would be ongoing. So we were, for about the next 2 or 3 weeks, we were just working all kinds of hours.
Financially, it sounds pretty grim.
Well, it is. Except this was expected. As I said, we closed down the three eastern plants immediately. Now, that some people have to stay to wind up the loose ends, and those are allowable costs. But basically, you're closing down three plants, and you have no use for anyone there other than the people. In other words, someone's got to stay there until the government gets its disposition instructions for government property. In other words, are you going to ship it somewhere?
Right.
Are you going to sell it for scrap or whatever the disposition is? But you can't walk off and leave it. So you have to have somebody doing those things. Somebody's got to, in accounting, has got to stay there and make sure that all the costs are recorded and all these things. And whatever the normal backlog is, you have to record. And this is a small fraction of the total employment. And then the other thing that happened, which was kind of a tough situation, when the war ended, Douglas essentially went back to really two plants, because Long Beach had not very much left. And but this meant all these people they had sent back from Santa Monica to be the management in the eastern and the midwestern plants, for example, three plant managers back there. Now they had to scramble for a job because they had been replaced by somebody who had moved up, and that was one tough situation because some of the plant managers out here preferred the assistant plant managers they had had for the entire war by this process of moving one over here and moving somebody else up, or maybe hiring from the outside or however they got, didn't want the plant manager. And Douglas had made no guarantees to these people. You know, he kind of waved the flag and the people had gone off and become plant manager and so on. But it was a real political battle of the people and the positions out there to get back to something comparable to Douglas, and they couldn't use that many. So somebody had to go. So it meant people were being let out who, and some were fairly bitter about them.
And especially in an area, there's not many places for them to go because all the other.
That's right, everyone else
are
in the same boat.
Doing exactly the same thing.
And to get back to the mood was one of practically everyone being worried about his job. And the favorite joke, which had certainly some truth to it, was you as an employee saying to your secretary, if my boss calls, get his name. They were changing that fast. And this was more truth than fiction. And no one could really see too much on the horizon. Now Douglas, I don't know how to say this or not, but Douglas, in my humble opinion, made the wrong decision at the end of World War II. They decided that the DC-6 was ready to go in the production and build it. They just built the three prototypes under an Air Force development contract, as had the other major aircraft companies. Well, Douglas made the decision that they could get back enough of the domestic business to be able to survive and do well post-war without government contracts. Historically, this had never been possible. That's the only way the aircraft industry had ever survived, was having, call it what you will, but enough government business to keep them going. They had never really made it on their commercial business alone. One of the reasons is the development costs of a new era of airplanes is terribly expensive. And if you are the unsuccessful one, in other words, if, let's say the three of the major companies all develop the next era of airliners, and one of them is probably going to get the lion's share of the market, the other two cannot afford all those development costs. They're just staggering. And today, of course, many more dollars than it was then. Well, anyway, Douglas had some lean years as a result, where they had to cut back still further. Now, the company that probably did the best was, Boeing did the best in general, but North American did better than they had before the war, simply because they branched out into other types of aircraft, smaller ones. But Douglas tried a few outside ventures, and were fairly disastrous. They had a metal skating rink somebody dreamed of. Well, you know, the market for skating rinks can't be very large under any optimistic set of assumptions. Well, the point of it was that they could do it in the metal forming shop with their equipment, and they could do it fairly reasonably. And then they came out with some kind of a metal rowboat, and, you know, but these never panned out. It was just the wrong business for them. And they finally had to go crawling back to the government and get on the list and gradually work their way back into government contracts.
Let's pause here.